Anderson, over the last several months, I've disparaged your name in an attempt to garner respect and attention for my own. That was wrong, and I apologize. My actions were unsportsmanlike, they were uncalled for, though they weren't mean-spirited, I do regret them. As you know, I've recently become the number one contender, which is a position that respectfully and immediately I am resigning from. I wish no further confrontation with you in the octagon or through the media. In short, I surrender. Signed, your friend, Chael P. Sonnen. P.S. I changed my mind. Anderson, you kissed my ass. Include the obnoxious laugh.
That was Chael Sonnen from UFC, once again stoking the fires with Anderson Silva, his soon-to-be opponent, in what is probably going to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, fight for UFC on pay-per-view this year. And this guy knows how to build up a fight. In fact, I listened to that and I wondered to myself, why is this man not in pro wrestling? I know he's best friends or something with CM Punk. I mean, imagine the two of them in a feud, verbally sparring on WWE TV. Imagine how awesome that would be. Anyway, he's got a career in wrestling if he wants one when this fight thing is over. This is episode 209 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com for Sunday, March 11th, 2012. I am the Sala Monster. Hope everybody here stateside remember to turn the clocks back. Well, turn the clocks forward, I guess. We lost an hour of sleep last night, damn it. But the good part about that is that it'll be lighter later, so it won't be so damn dark when I get out of work, which is always depressing. We're going to talk about Raw. Got a couple of other minor items just to note here. And then we're going to get into the mailbag, a larger mailbag this week. I'm severely backlogged, so I want to try to get to as many questions as I can, since it was kind of a light news week, so we'll do that. First things first, though, Raw was in Boston, or as I guess they say, Boston, this past Monday night. The home, well, not really the hometown. I guess John Cena is from West Newbury, Massachusetts. I don't know how far West Newbury is from Boston, but I guess it's close enough, since Boston is considered his hometown, which is where they were on Monday night. And typically when John Cena is in his hometown, it doesn't mean anything. If anything, he gets booed even more vociferously than usual. I didn't get the sense that was the case on this show, although he was booed. We'll get to that. We're going to do another traditional review here. I'll just go through the show from start to finish. Raw Monday night, Road to WrestleMania starts with Shawn Michaels, who is, as I had predicted before, going to be the special guest referee for the Hell in a Cell match between Triple H and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 28. But it took an interesting path to get there on Monday night. Michaels came out. He was acting all smarmy and snarky, kind of like the old Shawn Michaels. And this was going on for a little bit longer than I think it should have. Michaels calls Triple H out, dying to know what made him change his mind. Because the last time we saw Shawn Michaels on Raw, it was like pulling teeth, trying to get Triple H to accept this match with The Undertaker. And in the end, he refused to do it. And you'll recall that it wasn't until The Undertaker insinuated that Shawn Michaels has always been better than you. And since Shawn Michaels couldn't beat me, neither can you. That was the line that got Triple H so angry, so upset, so emotional, that he accepted The Undertaker's challenge for WrestleMania. So Michaels wants to know why. Triple H comes out, and Michaels shows the footage of Triple H accepting the challenge. And all of a sudden, Michaels' demeanor, who had been, you know, he had been happy and clowning around, and again, very sarcastic, all of a sudden his demeanor changed. And Michaels grew very serious and very angry at his best friend. He felt insulted by this. So that's what it took. That's what it took to get you to accept the challenge. You have a beef with me? That's essentially what was going on here. And Triple H tried to calm him down and says that Michaels was the greatest in-ring performer of all time, which is kind of funny because I remember him saying the exact same thing about Ric Flair when he inducted him into the Hall of Fame, but we'll forget that. And he says that, you know, it pains him, it pains Triple H to see that there are people out there who think of HBK as a loser because he could not beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. He says he wants to win this match, not just for himself, he wants to win this match for the both of them. And the way they played this up would make one believe that at WrestleMania, Michaels may well screw over Triple H. Of course, that's what they want you to think. Now, Undertaker's going to be back on Raw next week. There's going to be a face-to-face involving Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. We'll find out exactly what direction they're going to go with this. If they don't come out, like, blatantly just come out and have Undertaker suggest that, you know what, you two guys are in cahoots, I don't buy this for a second. I mean, that could very well be what happens. And going into WrestleMania, I could see WWE trying to play both sides of the card. You know, one week they lead you to believe that Michaels and Triple H are not rivals, but obviously there's a rift between the two of them, and Michaels may well be considering screwing Triple H over because he can't stomach the thought of his friend beating The Undertaker, which is something he couldn't do. And maybe the next week after that, they suggest, well, you know, maybe Michaels and Triple H are in cahoots here, so perhaps he's going to screw over The Undertaker and help his best friend and help end the streak. Maybe like you remember that Rock Triple H match from the first SmackDown back in August of 99 when Michaels was the guest referee for the championship match, Rock and Triple H, and Rock's coming off the ropes for a people's elbow, and Michaels super kicks him in the face and embraces his friends, going for that sort of finish. So we'll see what happens in the segment with Undertaker and Michaels this week. If they don't bring that up as a possibility, I could see them just continuing to tease dissension between DX going into Mania, and then in the Hell in a Cell match, there's this one big spot where Michaels just turns on Undertaker, super kicks him in the face, people are just gobsmacked, Triple H crawl, the slow crawl over for one of those great near falls. We'll see which way they go with this. This was a really good segment. I like what they're doing with this. I think putting Michaels in there introduces some element that match last year did not have. It's just interesting because there were rumors last year that Michaels was going to be the referee, and they dropped those plans. So essentially they're going with a year-old plan. They were going to do it last year. They're going to do it now instead. And I was one of those people who, before this match got officially announced, I was not a fan of putting Triple H in there again with The Undertaker. And I'm still not a fan of that, by the way. I just don't see there being a need to have Triple H have three matches, all three of which he's going to lose at WrestleMania, when you can put somebody fresh in there with Undertaker. And I mean, John Cena would be the ideal. He's a little bit busy this year. You could have come up with somebody else. You know, I ran through a bunch of potential options before. Sheamus, who won the Rumble. And again, you could have done something where, instead of Sheamus getting a title shot coming out of the Royal Rumble, you know, the Rumble this year, because it is 20-0 that Undertaker is trying to go after here, they could have made it into a really big deal by saying, you know what, the winner of the Rumble this year doesn't get a title shot. The winner of the Rumble gets a crack at The Undertaker and trying to break the streak, trying to make sure he does not go 20-0. I mean, Sheamus won the Rumble anyway, and he's probably going to be opening the show with Daniel Bryan, all due respect. It's not a situation where they're exactly treating the Rumble winner with any real respect. The Rumble has kind of lacked any real importance anyway now for a number of years, so why not do something like that? But they didn't go in that direction. So here we are with Undertaker Triple H. Even so, even though I'm not a fan of seeing this again, they're doing everything they can possibly do to make this match feel special. They have Michaels as the referee. They're putting the Hell in a Cell over these two guys. It's going to look really cool. It'll be very cool to see, you know, the whole Hell in a Cell structure there in an outdoor stadium. It's going to feel like a very big deal. And, you know, by introducing the Hell in a Cell, I really do believe we're going to see some level of violence in this match that we're not accustomed to seeing these days in WWE. Maybe we'll get some blood, maybe we won't. You know, we'll see what happens. But if we have to see this match for a third time, at least they're doing something different. They're not just adding a, you know, I quit stipulation or some bullshit like that to it. So, you know, I'm getting pretty amped up for it. I'm sure it'll be a good match. These guys, you know, Undertaker wrestles once a year. Triple H doesn't wrestle that much more than that. I trust that these two guys, even though they're in their 40s and Undertaker is broken down, he's had a year off. He's had, you know, he had shoulder surgery in his time off. He had a hip operation. He supposedly lost some weight. Maybe he's in pretty good shape, you know, for one match. I'm sure they're going to go out there. They'll kick ass. It'll be fine. This segment was pretty good, if not a little bit long. We had Santino Marella and Jack Swagger for the United States Championship. This might have been Jack Swagger's first and only U.S. title defense on Raw since he beat Zack Ryder for the title. I guess it was probably, what, a month and a half ago at this point? 2 months? I don't know. Something like that. Just completely ridiculous. I don't know why they took the title off him in the first place. They were beating Zack up every single week anyway. Did you really have to take the title off of him? You know, that 30-day rule where you have to defend your championship in 30 days hasn't been enforced in WWE probably in like 10 years. But anyway, Swagger and Santino for the U.S. title. And Santino has been on quite a run lately. You know, he has been, he was in the Elimination Chamber match, although granted it was not something they had planned for. But nonetheless, he was in that match. Crowd went crazy for him. He's been on a roll, on a tear of late. And Santino wins the United States Championship. Place goes nuts. Hard to argue with that when you see the reaction of the crowd. And the U.S. title, which had been building some value. You know, Dolph Ziggler had that championship for a long time. And they did a very good job of building up that feud with Dolph Ziggler and Zack Ryder. And it's kind of amazing to me just to think back on that now, because I've almost forgotten about that feud. How good that was. And how well it was being built up. And how well the U.S. title had been built up. Because they had it on one guy for a long time, and Ziggler is a tremendous worker. So he was bringing some prestige back to a championship that had meant absolutely nothing, below nothing in WWE. And I even said at the time, I think I made a comment on one of the sound-offs, that I know WrestleMania is still a ways off, but there are ways in which you could have extended that feud. Even if you took a break, let's say there was a first match between Ziggler and Ryder, and Ziggler won through some chicanery, moved on to another feud, beaten somebody else, and then returned to Ryder. Ryder wanted his, you know, his rematch. You could have saved that for WrestleMania and made it really mean something. And now, you know, it's unfortunate because right now Zack Ryder is a man with no match at WrestleMania, and Dolph Ziggler, even more of a crime, is a man with no match at WrestleMania. And I'm sure both guys at the end of the day are going to be involved in that. That GM, Battle of the GMs, there's probably going to be some sort of multi-man match with Laurinaitis and Teddy Long, and they're going to have their surrogates. And you know what? If Ziggler gets in there and Ryder gets in there, that's great. They both deserve to be on WrestleMania, but they deserve to be in a match on their own and not just part of some multi-man, you know, clusterfuck. But anyway, Swagger has done nothing as champion. I could care less that he lost the title. You may as well put it on Santino. At least Santino is over. Swagger came out looking like Dennis the Menace or something with this new haircut. Just completely awful. And, yeah, Santino won the championship. The place went nuts. There was just a shit ton of different things going on because you had Teddy Long and Oksana and Kofi Kingston who came down. And, you know, you had John Laurinaitis was there with David Otunga and just so many different things going on. But big pop for Santino's title win, so that was kind of cool. We had The Rock on this show. And The Rock had his first of three history lessons for one John Cena. These were segments that were taped on Saturday, I believe. Either Saturday or Sunday. It was not taped the day of the show. And the first one was actually the best one, I thought. First of all, I thought these segments were fucking awesome. Even if you were not a fan of The Rock, I don't see how you cannot watch this first one and not chuckle. Unfortunately, they started out with the best one. The second one was also pretty good. The third one really wasn't all that great. But this first segment with Rock at the Boston Harbor for this first history lesson was just fantastic. He talked about the Boston Tea Party, and he had a table set up full of John Cena merchandise. And basically, this was almost like a rehash of him throwing the, it was Austin who threw the Intercontinental title in the river that time. Actually, him and Austin brawled by a bridge once. Remember, The Rock threw Stone Cold off a bridge. If only he would do that with John Cena. So basically, he was making fun of all the different Cena merchandise and tossing it into the water. And the best part of this entire thing was when he finally got to the John Cena Garden Gnome. Now, this was something I actually posted a link to this item, or somebody did, months ago on my Facebook page. This is a real item. And it should be noted here that there also is a Rock Garden Gnome, although he neglected to mention that part. But The Rock has this Garden Gnome, and he is just dumbfounded by this item.
We got the John Cena Garden Gnome. What fourth dimension of hell did this come from? There's a man right now in his 30s or 40s who actually has this in his garden, and he's a virgin. What else we got right here?
I just thought this was great. If anything, they made a mistake by showing this one first and not second or third, because that was the best part of all of these history lesson segments. But The Rock was on his A-game here. This was The Rock at his best. And as I said, there were two other history lessons. We'll get to that in a second. We had Eve Torres in a match against Alicia Fox. And if you blinked, you missed it. Kelly was on commentary for this match. and she was talking about Nickelodeon, or so I wasn't really paying attention to her words. I'm sure most people don't pay attention to her words, but nonetheless. Eve beat Alicia basically with what was like a leg sweep. 1-2-3, I mean, it was just pathetic. Again, why even send these women out there? Just do a backstage segment. I mean, if you're only doing this to set up something with Eve and Ryder, or you wanna have, you know, Kelly on commentary to talk about, you know, how Eve Torres has turned into a mean person, I don't know what's gotten into her and this and that, well, just let her do a backstage interview. Why even send them out there for a match? So Eve wins, and out comes Zack Ryder, who now is walking with a cane. And God bless Zack Ryder, you know. It's just this poor fucker comes out there every week, and you just shake your head, you know, whether it's a neck brace, a back brace, if he's in traction. Now he's down to a cane, which I guess is kind of an improvement. And it's kind of funny because the item that he was holding is actually named for the person who put him in the hospital in the first place. But anyway, he comes out walking with a cane. Apparently he's never walked with a cane before because he's doing it all wrong. He's basically, if you watch him when he left to go back to the locker room when he was done, he basically came out and you know, insulted Eve and then went to the back. But as he was walking back through the curtain, he just basically is walking like a normal person, and you could tell he has no idea how to use this thing. It was kind of funny, actually, when he had crutches as well. If you're somebody who's never used crutches before, you probably don't know how to walk properly with them. So it's almost like Zack is walking just like a normal person. And maybe it's done that way on purpose to add to the comedy. I don't think it is, but whatever. So he goes backstage, and there's a segment that came after this where Eve tracks him down in the back. She tracks down Zack, and she is, you know, I don't know why she would even pretend to be upset. She was caught on camera basically saying she does not give a fuck about Zack Ryder. He's a geek. He's a nerd. A guy like that would not know what to do with a woman like me. All of a sudden, I guess she's, you know, pretending that nobody heard any of that. Zack didn't hear it. Cena didn't hear it. We didn't hear it. She does care for Zack. Hold on a second. She's concerned that Zack is upset. And then she lays a wet one on him. After all this time, Eve finally kisses Zack, and he kisses her back, and she walks off, and, I mean, he was completely smitten with this woman. Now, when this segment was over, the only thing I could think is, what a fucking idiot. I mean, really, you talk about castrating a character and making him look like a complete goof. If that was their mission here, they succeeded. Now, my thought is this. They can't possibly be this stupid, okay? They can't possibly be this dumb. I refuse to believe that these people are this idiotic. There has to be a plan here. So I'm assuming that if it doesn't happen on Raw this week, because sometimes they can't help themselves and they blow their load too early, if they can hold off until WrestleMania, I don't know what they have planned, what match Zack is going to be in, and I don't even know what role Eve would play in that match. I would imagine they're not going to be in the same match together. It's just going to be men, you know, men only in this GM versus GM stuff. But regardless, my thought is that this is all going to culminate in something where Zack, perhaps at WrestleMania, on the grandest stage of them all, as they say, will embarrass Eve in front of the world. He will conspire with the other divas on the roster, with Kelly, and with maybe Natalya, and with Alicia, all these women who supposedly hate Eve, right? Heels and faces alike. I don't think Eve has any friends right now in WWE, in that women's locker room. So Zack will continue to pretend as though he is still smitten with Eve, but in reality, he's plotting his revenge on her, and he will embarrass her in some way, shape, or form, while probably conspiring with the other women. That's my belief. That's how I would handle it at this point, because if that's not the plan here, and Zack is falling for this woman all over again, I don't understand how anybody can be a Zack Ryder fan. Losers! Losers can be a Zack Ryder fan. So I'm going to reserve judgment on this, and assume that they cannot possibly be this stupid, which is probably a mistake on my part, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt on this. But this was stupid. Then we had a previously recorded sit-down interview with John Cena inside of an empty TD Garden arena. And I swear when I first saw this, my first thought was, they finally found a way to get John Cena in his hometown, in the arena, on TV, without getting booed. All they had to do was take the people out of it. Brilliant. Brilliant move on their part. So Cena's sitting alone in the stands, and I'm sure whoever was sitting in that section, you know, live in the building watching this up on the Titantron, you probably had at least a dozen people in that section who were looking at each other's seats, trying to figure out which seat was the one that Cena was sitting in. So Cena is doing this promo. He's talking about the match with The Rock and how important it is, and he keeps gazing up at that WrestleMania 28 sign, and he says that, you know, The Rock is the most successful wrestler in the history of WWE, and John Cena says, I have to win this match. Nobody remembers second place. And he gives examples. He talks about the New England Patriots, who a couple of seasons ago were the most dominant team in the NFL. They went 18-0, and they lost to the New York Giants in the Super Bowl. And they went 18-1. And his argument here was, nobody remembers second place. What? Everybody remembers that Patriots team losing. That's why they remember them, because they won every game and they lost. They choked in the Super Bowl. I shouldn't say they choked. They played a good game, but they lost. You just said it yourself. They're remembered for losing that game. It's just completely ridiculous. But, you know, I understand why they were doing it. You know, his argument is, listen, you know, it's like winning in the Olympics. I think that would have been a far better example for him to give. You know, when you have somebody who wins a gold medal, a silver, and a bronze in the Olympics, whether it's Olympic wrestling or whatever it may be, look at Kurt Angle. And I know why they couldn't use the name Kurt Angle, but that would have been a tremendous example for him to use. Or any other Olympic athlete, for that matter. But Kurt Angle won a gold medal in the 1996 Olympics. And I think it was some Iranian guy he beat to win the gold. But so I know that, but most people don't know who the second place winner is, who won the silver, who won the bronze. You know, that's a much better example to use. But whatever, I'll cut him some slack. I know why it was scripted this way. But I will say that I appreciate them trying to do something different here. There were parts of this I liked. I like the idea of doing something like this. It does make the match feel more special. But whoever scripted the interview, this was not the best verbiage for Cena to be using. It had the problem that a lot of John Cena promos have. It sounded too rehearsed. You know, it didn't sound like it was coming from the heart. You could take a guy like Chris Jericho or CM Punk or The Rock and get him riled up, get him all, you know, angry and full of piss and vinegar, and let them go out there and cut a promo, and they can make it sound real, like it's coming from the heart. They really feel that way. I never got that impression listening to John Cena here. I don't know if that's a problem with whoever's writing his interviews. I don't know if it's a problem with Cena and his inability to be serious in an interview like that. He did fine with what he had, but this didn't grab me, I think, as much as it should have. And it's interesting because that part when he said he has to win, and I think he stressed that more than once, I have to win this match. It did remind me, and I saw other people comment on this, it did remind me of that promo that Steve Austin and The Rock had before WrestleMania 17. You know, one of the greatest WrestleManias, if not the greatest Mania show from top to bottom of all time, one of the biggest main events in Mania history, was that second Rock-Austin match. And I don't remember if it was the week before or 2 weeks before, but they did this great sit-down promo in the back. It was in front of a bunch of lockers in the locker room. You had Jim Ross moderating and sitting in between Stone Cold and The Rock. And it was a very serious interview. It was not meant for comedy. It was completely straight, completely serious about why both these men feel they have to win the match. And when Stone Cold was talking about why he thinks he has to win, you know, he said virtually the exact same thing. He said, I need to beat you, Rock. I need that more than anything you could ever imagine. That was what Stone Cold said. And, of course, we all know what happened at WrestleMania. Austin, he did whatever he had to do to win the championship, which meant turning heel and aligning himself with Vince McMahon. Now, does this foreshadow a heel turn by John Cena at WrestleMania? No. I would not read that much into it. John Cena is not going to turn heel. But it did remind me of that interview. So for the people who mentioned that, you were not the only ones who thought of that interview before WrestleMania X7, because I actually thought the exact same thing. But unlike WrestleMania X7, again, I do not think the outcome is going to be similar. I think the outcome will be the same in that Austin said that and won the match. And in this case, I think John Cena said that and he too is going to win the match. But I don't see a Cena heel turn being foreshadowed here. We had Chris Jericho and Daniel Bryan, kind of a dream tag team for some people, against CM Punk and Sheamus. Jericho and Bryan got the win. Jericho actually pinned Punk to win the match. And it was, I don't know if it was botched. I guess it wasn't botched. But basically what happened is, first of all, you had Punk in there with Jericho, which is just so fucking stupid. I hate it when they do that. You know, that's one of your WrestleMania main events. And granted, Punk and Jericho were taking a backseat to the other two big matches. So I guess in a way it doesn't even matter. But I would like to keep these guys apart as much as possible so it feels more special once they're in there. But, again, it probably doesn't even matter. But they're in there together, and basically the end of the match comes when Jericho... Punk reversed a Walls of Jericho with a roll-up. And Jericho kind of reversed that into a roll-up or a cradle or whatever of his own. And the way that it was filmed, it almost looked like both of their shoulders were down. So I thought it was going to be one of these things where, you know, the bell rings and we don't know who's the winner. You know, the referee doesn't know. He says, oh, I don't know. Both their shoulders were down, so there's no winner. But apparently Punk's shoulders were down. So Jericho won, and he posed, I think, with the title belt and all that stuff. So whatever, it advances the feud between them. Jericho being the challenger, the heel, he gets one over on the champion. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, I wouldn't put them in the ring every week. I don't want to see Chris Jericho in the ring with CM Punk every single week. You know, you want to do it this week, fine. You can only do so much talking with them. You know, we're seeing that with Rock and Cena. All they do every week is yak, 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 because that's what they have to do to sell the match. So at the end of the day, not a big deal, but I would want to keep these guys apart as much as possible. We had the second Rock History promo. This one was in front of the statue of Paul Revere. And the thing that cracked me up about this one was the constant close-ups to Paul Revere and the horse. I don't know what that was about, but that actually was the funniest part of the whole segment. Rock talked about what would happen. What would have happened if John Cena was the one who came into town as opposed to Paul Revere to say that the British were coming? And Rock argued that Cena would be shot on sight for wearing those stupid purple shirts and the people would be sick of him. And Rock talked about beating up Cena, going back in time in a time machine with the flux capacitor, Back to the Future reference, which I popped for. And actually, I should say the best part of this whole thing was his rendition of, he sang, what the hell is the name of that song? I already forgot the name of the song. But basically, he sang a song and replaced the lyrics with John Cena's name and talked about sticking a feather up his ass and calling him a jabroni. And he put one of those goofy British hats on and whatever. But this was funny. This was funny, and not as good as the first segment, but this was fine. And I got the impression that when the people first saw The Rock up on the Titantron, that some of them may have seen that and said, holy shit, I thought he was going to be here. He's not going to be here? And people may have been a little reluctant to cheer The Rock in that first segment. But I think it was the second one when he actually specifically said, I'm going to meet you in the ring tonight, or I'm going to meet you at the arena, and the people pop. So I think at that point, maybe people were a little worried, oh shit, you know, he's via satellite again, he's taped a bunch of segments, he's not actually going to be here. And then Rock confirmed, I am going to be there later, and people kind of opened up a little more. So that was kind of interesting. We have Big Show and Miz in a match. I can't even really call it a match. Cody Rhodes came out before the match, talked about Big Show at WrestleMania 18. You might be asking yourself, well, what match did Big Show have at WrestleMania 18? Well, that's the thing. He didn't. He didn't have a match at WrestleMania 18. Back then, WWF had a restaurant/nightclub in New York called WWF New York, which eventually, I think, only became a nightclub called The World. And I actually went to the WWF New York restaurant not long after it opened, and I'm actually really sad it's not there anymore. It was actually really, really cool. You would walk in, and they actually had wrestling theme music on. That was the music that you heard throughout the store. You walk into a WWE shop, basically. It was an actual merchandise store, and they had T-shirts and hats and clothes and DVDs and all that stuff. And then you would go down a flight of stairs to the actual restaurant. And the food there actually wasn't pretty bad. It was actually pretty decent stuff. So, you know, too bad it's not there. It's not cheap to maintain real estate in the middle of Times Square. So, unfortunately, it didn't last very long, but that's where Big Show was, at WrestleMania 18. A man who, just a few years earlier, was main eventing WrestleMania 16. He was fighting for the WWE Championship, and 2 years later, he was at The World. He was at The World Restaurant in Times Square when everybody else was up in Toronto. Big Show was in Times Square, basically posing with little kids and going, woo! And that was, by the way, the fucking best part of this whole thing. Big Show actually said woo, and and then they had a graphic on the screen that said woo. So that was just phenomenal. And Big Show basically just punched Miz in the head. Punched him with the knockout blow. 1-2-3, match over. So Miz continues his downward spiral. I have seen some people suggest that Miz may interfere in the Rock Cena match at WrestleMania. Not that it would necessarily have any influence on the finish, but You know, Miz has talked about how a year ago he headlined WrestleMania against John Cena, and he actually beat John Cena. And, of course, Miz and Rock have no love lost. Rock beat up Miz at the end of WrestleMania last year, just like he beat up Miz at Survivor Series at MSG. So maybe they're beating Miz down and beating him down and beating him down like this, and maybe he won't have a match at WrestleMania, and he'll try to interfere in the main event and kind of unite Rock and Cena to both beat the hell out of him. I would not put much stock into that. I will say if it happened, I wouldn't be thoroughly surprised, but the idea of Miz, or anybody, let alone Miz, interfering in what they're billing as the biggest match in WWE history, I don't think that works. I don't think you need Miz or anybody to be running in that main event match. I think that would be a bad idea. So I think Miz is just in the doghouse, and he's losing every week. He's being made to look like a fool. I don't think you reward that by having him come down and interfering in the supposedly biggest match of all time. So I would not put much faith in that scenario there. But certainly this week, he did not look good, and that sucks for him. Rock was shown in that last segment, the last history segment at Boston Common. He talked about the overthrow of the British, and he basically threatened Cena. He said that at WrestleMania, Cena will fall to The Rock, and he was on his way to the arena. They announced Undertaker will be on Raw next week. I would not expect them to show us his bald or nearly bald head. I would guess they're probably going to save that for WrestleMania. He'll probably just come out in a hood next week. Although, again, I would pop if Shawn Michaels just, you know, some of that old DX came out of him and he just reached up and yanked the hood off Undertaker's head. That would be kind of funny. Kane and R-Truth had a match. R-Truth didn't fare much better on this show than his former tag team partner did, although he got a little bit more offense in, I think, on the Big Red Machine, but not much. And Kane beat him 1-2-3 after a choke slam. Randy Orton came out, gave Kane an RKO, and said that it was good to be back, and then he left. Okay. I guess that was because when Kane attacked Orton on SmackDown, he basically said, welcome back, because Orton had been out with an injury. So Orton beat up Kane, said it was good to be back, and I guess this just continues the build to their match at WrestleMania. And I see where some people are saying, well, maybe it'll be like a last man standing match or something like that. They really can't add a stipulation to this match because it's the first match. It's like almost like the Vince Russo ass-backwards way of booking, where you book the gimmick match first, and eventually it leads to a straight singles match. It doesn't work that way. If you're going to have Orton and Kane one-on-one at WrestleMania, just like Orton and Punk last year at WrestleMania, it has to be a straight singles match that eventually builds maybe on the next pay-per-view to a gimmick match. That's how it works. You don't start with the fucking gimmick match. So if they're going to do that match, it's going to be one-on-one. John Cena came out for the final segment of the show, yet another talking main event. We had Cena talking about the Rock's segments and how funny they were, and he said that Rock was shaken up last week when John Cena came out to interrupt his promo and talk about the writing on his wrist and all that stuff. He said, Rock was stuttering like Rain Man. And as many of you so astutely pointed out on Twitter, that was actually a line that I used on the Sound Off last week when I compared The Rock's constant stammering and stuttering when he was going, John, John, John. And I said, God, this guy sounded like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. So, kind of funny to see Cena make a Rain Man reference on this show. I'll leave it at that. And by the way, it was the Yankee Doodle song, I think, is the song I was thinking of before. I had a brain fart there, but I think that's what it was. Anyway, Rock came out eventually. Rock came down to the ring, no posing. He was all business, which is, again, how I would like to see Cena sometimes. But Rock was all business, came right into the ring, grabbed the microphone, talked about he sees fear in John Cena's eyes. This is what Rock had said he was going to do all night. He was teasing that he was going to look John Cena in the eye and tell us all what he saw. And The Rock said, what I see is fear. Fear that I'm going to take everything away from John Cena. In one night, in one match, I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to undo everything that you've accomplished over the last 8 years, or however long it's been. That's basically what Rock was saying here. And they stared at each other. Cena, of course, was grinning. He just cannot help himself. John Cena is just a happy-go-lucky guy, and if he's not smiling broadly from ear to ear, he's grinning or smirking. It's, you know, it's the kind of thing where if I were his opponent, I'm staring this man in the face, I'm being serious, I don't like him, and all he can do is stand there and smile and grin, I would want to backhand him and knock all of the teeth out of his mouth. That didn't happen here, but the fans actually started to chant Tooth Fairy at one point at The Rock, and The Rock kind of looked out at the crowd and I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, you can make the argument, oh, they're in Boston, it's Cena's hometown. I don't buy that, though, because more often than not, Cena gets booed in his hometown. So I don't think it was a hometown thing at all. I think perhaps what WWE is trying to do is starting to work. You know, what they want is a more split crowd reaction. They've done everything in their power, going back to the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. Because that whole Cena-Kane feud, to me, did nothing to help Cena. It wasn't until after the Elimination Chamber show that the real effort to me started. You know, they showed that promo at the last pay-per-view with Cena in the gym down in Florida with Seth Rollins and all those guys working out. And, you know, they had Cena rag on Eve on Raw the night after the pay-per-view, and that was actually pretty cool. When she was down on her knees crying and he said, you know, I don't want to catch any diseases from you, and the crowd kind of popped big. And they've been going out of their way to try to get the people to cheer Cena. They want people so badly to cheer this man. And, again, they're fighting a losing fight as far as WrestleMania is concerned. Because Cena's going to go out there. I mean, he'll be cheered by some people and by the kids. But you're going to have 65, 70,000 people there, 90% plus of which are going to be cheering for The Rock. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. It doesn't matter what they do between now and then. You're not going to get a true split 50-50 down the middle reaction. It takes me back to WrestleMania 18 when The Rock had that match with Hulk Hogan. And The Rock was clearly the babyface going into this match. I mean, for God's sake, Hulk Hogan tried to murder The Rock. He tried to literally run him down in a semi-truck. And the people still went crazy for Hogan. Hogan came out at the Sky Dome and got a reaction the likes of which I've never seen before. It was just amazing. And Rock, to his credit, played it perfectly. You know, as the match progressed, The Rock would look out to the crowd with this reaction like he was really angry, like playing it up like a heel. And it was great. But on commentary, the thing I remember is how badly Jim Ross was trying to convince us that it was a split reaction from the crowd. Wow, this is a very mixed crowd here in Toronto. And I like Jim Ross. I do. I think Jim Ross is a tremendous announcer, probably the greatest of all time. But he was so full of shit at WrestleMania, it's not even funny. And I listen to Jim Ross talk now, because Jim Ross has done interviews and Legends roundtables and stuff where he's talked about that. And you can tell it wasn't something that was really being fed to him that night. At least I don't think. It was Jim Ross who probably was also caught a little bit off guard by how vocal the crowd was that night at WrestleMania in favor of Hulk Hogan. And was really he almost seemed offended by it. I mean, I know he's good friends with The Rock and helped bring The Rock over to WWE and all that. And it's almost like Jim Ross took great personal offense to the crowd's reaction that night. You know, when Hogan used his weight belt on Rock in that match and was whipping him and the people were going nuts. And then Rock got a hold of Hogan's weight belt and he started using it on Hogan. You go back and listen to Jim Ross on commentary even then. And he said, you know, hey, Hogan used the belt first. Hogan used the belt first. Like it or not, that's your call, fans. Jim Ross was such a dick that night at WrestleMania 18. It was kind of funny. So that's what this reminds me of. WWE is trying so badly to go for the split crowd reaction. And when WrestleMania comes, you watch. You'll have Michael Cole on commentary saying, well, this crowd is really divided. Bullshit. The crowd is not going to be divided. If there's any sort of division at WrestleMania, it'll be 80-20. Or 90-10 in favor of The Rock. That's just the way it's going to be. But on the Raw shows between now and then, it seems like what they're looking to do might be working. Now, I don't really see what the big deal is. I mean, if you have an audience who loves The Rock and hates John Cena, that's great. As long as they're reacting. If people hate Cena, great. Let them boo Cena. Let them bring their signs. Let them wear their, you know, Cena sucks t-shirts that WWE themselves made. You know, they so badly don't want John Cena to be booed, yet they go ahead and they make t-shirts that say Cena sucks. Doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but okay. But it looks like it might be starting to work. Some people are booing The Rock. They were chanting Tooth Fairy. I mean, it's one show. Rock's going to be on Raw every single week between now and Mania. Maybe next week he comes out, gets a tremendous reaction, and Cena is booed out of the building. I don't know. We'll see. But for now, it looks like it might be working, even though it's not going to make a damn bit of difference come April 1st. Rock talked about, you strip away catchphrases, you strip away the gimmicks, I'm 6'4", 270 pounds, and I'm going to rip your throat out. That was a money line right there. That was a money line. He wasn't trying to be cute. He wasn't talking about sticking objects up Cena's, you know, lady parts or anything like that. He basically said, I'm a big guy. I'm going to rip your throat out of WrestleMania. And what did John Cena do in response to this? He grinned. of course. Rock called Cena a little boy who's going to go down as Rock's bitch, and he left. And then Cena continued his promo from there, and, you know, he basically said, I think he said something to the effect of this son of a bitch is going to beat you at WrestleMania, or something like that. And that was that. John Cena went, celebrated with some friends and family in the front row, and that was Raw for Monday night. A pretty good show overall. It was actually a lot like the show from the last week, the week before, which started out strong, ended pretty strong, and had a lot of filler and a lot of crap in the middle. This show was very similar, actually, to that show. There was a lot of filler, a lot of crap in the middle. Santino's title win was kind of a feel-good moment, just like that feel-good moment on SmackDown a couple months ago when he won the Battle Royal to get into the Chamber match. People love Santino, and that was a pretty good feel-good moment right there. But other than that, you know, everything else, the focus is clearly on those two top matches at WrestleMania, and Punk and Jericho to a lesser degree, which is the way it should be. But they're going to have to start fleshing out the rest of the card. We know there's going to be some sort of a multi-man match involving, you know, like Team Laurinaitis against Team Long or something like that. And I know they were, at one point anyway, thinking of making it a Money in the Bank match. Now it's probably going to be some sort of tag match, maybe like a Survivor Series-style elimination match. I just pray that it's not a Battle Royal. As I've said before, we've seen so many Battle Royals this year alone. We had a 30-man Rumble, and within a month of that Rumble, we had a Battle Royal on SmackDown and a Battle Royal on Raw. A Battle Royal, mind you, where people were practically maimed. Poor Wade Barrett is going to be out at least 4 months after having surgery on his elbow. He's out of WrestleMania for sure. I mean, I guess he could show up in a sling, but he ain't going to be able to do much. So let's stay away from the Battle Royals this 1 year. I wanted to comment really quickly on something I noticed that was on Impact Wrestling this week. Again, I did not see the entire show, but apparently they're doing a storyline where Abyss's brother has arrived at TNA looking for his brother. Abyss has not been seen on TNA television apparently for a few months now, and this mysterious person in a business suit showed up on television this week, showed up at the Impact Zone in Orlando, calling himself Joseph Park. Very well-dressed man with thick black glasses, and he came into the building. There was a segment that I saw where he introduced himself to Crimson and Matt Morgan and asked them if they knew anything about his brother. Had they seen him? And they didn't know who he was talking about. He said, "My brother, Chris Abyss." And they were amazed that this man was related in any way, shape, or form, or that Abyss had any brother at all. And I see some people online saying that, didn't they say Judas Macias was Abyss's brother? And I don't remember that. I don't remember if they said that or not. But it's wrestling. Plot holes like that are going to be there. You can't really avoid that. But this guy was, he was asking questions, and he was wondering if these guys could steer him to anybody who might be able to tell him where his brother is, and they couldn't help him. And he said, "All right, thank you, gentlemen, for your time," and he walked off. And that's all I saw. I don't know if he appeared in any other segments on the show. Those, you know, that one and the one where he got into the building are the ones I saw. And I got to tell you, I'm already hooked. They've got me hooked on this storyline. I don't know where it's going, but to see this guy portraying this role, and by the way, it is Abyss. That is Abyss without the mask, playing the role of his own brother. You can just tell anyway. I mean, his body type, his voice, I probably would have been able to tell anyway, even if I didn't know that it was Abyss. But I thought, again, these are only two segments here. He didn't do much. This was phenomenal. I look at Abyss in this role, and I think to myself, this guy could have a career for himself, whether it's as a wrestler or a Jim Cornette type of manager, if he dresses up like that every week. He doesn't even have to go back to being Abyss. As Abyss, he put his body through hell. He scarred up his body. He gets slammed down on thumbtacks and barbed wire. He's done those matches for years. Plus, the Abyss character, in a lot of ways, needs to be freshened up. It's very played out. Only two segments. Too early to really tell where they go with this, but to me, I watched this and I thought to myself, I can't believe this is the same person. But it is. So he may have found a new role for himself. I mean, eventually I'm sure they'll have the reveal that it's actually him. You know, he's claimed he's looking for his brother. Kind of like when Kane was looking for the culprit who attacked The Undertaker at that Memorial Day barbecue a couple of years ago. And of course, at the end of the day, it was actually Kane himself who attacked his brother. So the big reveal will come at some point. Sorry to spoil it for you. And I don't know if they'll, you know, be able to come up with something good or if they'll fuck it up in the end. But I watched this and I was amazed. I applauded this guy. This was tremendous. You just watch this and you would never think. This is the same guy. This is the same guy that comes out there and acts like a fool and, you know, again, gets slammed down on weapons and shit. He really could have something here in some sort of new role in TNA. So I am actually very intrigued to see where they go with this. And if you didn't see those segments, you could find him on YouTube. Go ahead and check him out. Because, again, he was very well-spoken, very well-dressed, the exact opposite of everything we've come to know Abyss for in his time at TNA. And that's one TNA storyline I can honestly say I am genuinely intrigued to see where they go with it. And, yes, I do think Abyss does bear a striking resemblance to Penn Jillette. It's actually quite uncanny. You look at the guy, just his form and his hair and even his face a little bit and the glasses. He looks like Penn Jillette. He really does. And let's just hope then in that case that the storyline does not turn out to be bullshit, which of course is something Penn and Teller are known for. Penn and Teller, by the way, for those of you who don't know, I always have to qualify my statements and remember that there's people either who are very young who listen to the show or who live in other countries who probably have absolutely no idea what a Penn Jillette is. They probably think it's a pen that has, like, gel ink. It is actually a person. He's a comedian here in the States. And if you look a picture of Penn Jillette up online and compare it to the Joseph Park picture from when he was on Impact on Thursday, I think you'll see there's a resemblance between the two. But it is, in fact, not Penn Jillette. I can tell you that. Couple of other miscellaneous notes here before we move on to the shout-out and mailbag portion of the show. Sad story, actually. It was reported on TMZ this week that Kia Stevens, known better in WWE as Karma, the former Awesome Kong, who, of course, has been out for quite some time. She was with child, as we found out last year, and she was going to give birth. Supposedly, she gave birth to a baby boy at the very end of December, I believe. And, in fact, that was a lie. She did not have the baby. I believe the baby was stillborn, and she lost the child, and obviously that could be a very traumatic thing. It happens, unfortunately, to a lot of people, and is something that is just a very sad story. There's nothing else really to say about it. There's no timetable as far as when she will be back on WWE television. I would hope and assume they're not, you know, going to rush her back. She'll have as much time as she needs to get over this and try to move on with her life. And she said on Twitter, I think, that she was, you know, thinking about starting some sort of foundation for women who have been through similar things before. And anything like that would be fantastic. Any way that she feels she can help other people going through the same thing, I think, is a very noble thing on her part. Again, no timetable for her comeback. And so I've said before that the only real challenger I care to see for Beth Phoenix and her Divas title at WrestleMania was Karma. And, in fact, that was the plan. Karma was going to be back on TV very shortly. That will not happen now. My guess would be that would not happen unless Karma goes to WWE and says, no, I want to come back to work. I want to do the match. I guess it's possible that could happen. But I'm assuming she is, in fact, not going to be part of WrestleMania, which means I guess you can do Beth and Natalya, even though that match does absolutely nothing for me. There is an interesting thing here that is worth mentioning. There was a note on many of the websites, I believe, including SE Scoops, that WWE has reached out very recently to a former diva from many, many years ago. In fact, she's one of the most famous divas, not just in WWE history, but in wrestling history, for something that occurred during the Monday Night Wars. And, of course, I'm talking about Medusa, who was known in her WWE heyday as Alundra Blaze. She's also been known as Medusa Miceli. Medusa was the one who, she was the WWF Women's Champion at a time when the company decided that they were no longer going to have women's wrestling. So they essentially dropped the division. I think they dropped her. But she still had physical possession of the old pink WWF Women's belt. Eric Bischoff, who was raiding talent from Vince McMahon at that time, saw an opportunity to really stick it to Vince McMahon, signed Medusa to come back to WCW where she had been previously. And she just showed up on one episode of Monday Nitro and literally dropped the WWF women's belt into a trash can on live TV. And I believe she has said, I think, she still has possession of the title. And I don't think that Vince McMahon was, I don't think Vince McMahon has ever had any desire to bring her back. He still remembers that. And Vince is the kind of person, he's, you know, made up with a lot of guys that jump ship to WCW have come back to WWF. I mean, for God's sake, Vince made up with Hulk Hogan. But, you know, he recognized there was business to be made. I think with Medusa, it was a little bit different. You know, when Vince feels he's being backstabbed by somebody, it's very different. He felt he was backstabbed, for example, by Randy Savage when he left WWF and ended up going to WCW. And I think that more than anything probably had to do with the animosity that Vince had towards Savage up until the time he died. So with Medusa, she has never been back to WWF. She has never done anything affiliated with WWE since that time. And now, apparently, the company has reached out to her. And she may, in fact, be in Miami for WrestleMania. Not that she'll necessarily be at the show on television, on camera, as a character. But apparently, they want to talk to her about potentially doing stuff with the new network. They're reaching out to a lot of older talent. They're going to need a lot of those people to contribute for this new network that's launching. But I bring this up because it's interesting. If Karma is out of WrestleMania, Medusa has actually cut promos on YouTube in recent weeks on Beth Phoenix. She has started very much what is a one-sided Twitter war with Beth Phoenix. I don't know that Beth has ever responded back to her. Maybe she has. But clearly she was doing these videos and these promos to try to get back into WWE, to try to get a match with Beth Phoenix. Well, I don't know how much it's going to mean to the average WWE fan in 2012. Probably nothing. In fact, it goes against everything WWE would do, because Medusa now, I mean, she's got to be in her mid to late 40s, my guess would be. Personally, I think it would be a great idea to bring her back and to do something with Beth Phoenix. If the Karma thing has fallen through, they don't have anything better on the agenda. The only diva they're doing something with right now is a heel, and that's Eve. So it doesn't make any sense to put Eve in there with Beth Phoenix. At the same time, you do some sort of women's multiple-person match, it don't mean shit. So at least if you're bringing back somebody that some people know, and you run some vignettes on television, you know, in the 2 weeks leading up to WrestleMania that show her from her WWF days, that show her from her WCW days, that show her dropping the title in the trash can on Nitro, and showing the fact that she was a big figure back in the day, and you bring her in as the, you know, trying to knock Beth Phoenix off her perch, kind of the old guard against the new guard, that seems to be the theme of WrestleMania this year. Whether it's Rock and Cena, if it's Punk and Jericho, it's kind of the old breed against the new breed, they can push that same storyline with Medusa and Beth Phoenix. So I'm not saying that's why she's going to be in Miami. I'm just saying keep an open mind about this, because it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could strike some sort of deal and she could potentially have a match at WrestleMania. But it goes against everything WWE would do, because she's so much older than the other divas. WWE, to me anyway, has had a bias over the years against older women. You know, Vicky Guerrero is an exception, but Vicky is not a wrestler. Vicky is not only not a wrestler, but she's also the widow of, a dead wrestler who was a main event guy in WWE. So her success, you know, she got over on her own, in spite of the fact that she's an older woman who doesn't necessarily have the body of a Kelly Kelly. And even then, WWE has certainly poked fun at Vicky's weight on television. They still do. That's just how they are. But somebody, I don't want to say as old as her, because, you know, somebody in their 40s is not old. They're old relative to all of the younger talent on the roster. And if WWE actually did this, it would kind of shock me, actually. Not even because she dropped the belt in the trash can back in 1995. It would shock me just because they so clearly have a bias towards older women. You know, it's a young person's sport, for lack of a better term. That's why Jim Ross is not on television. He's too old and he looks weird and whatever. That's just how they are. So, anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. She's doing something with WWE. It may only be network-related. She may not even be on TV. But if Karma is out of the picture, I would be totally open to the idea of doing something with her and Medusa at WrestleMania. I know a lot of you have been asking me for my thoughts on the Hulk Hogan sex tape controversy. I'd rather not, quite frankly. I want to eat something when the show is over, and I fear that if I go too deep into the story, I may lose my appetite. But basically, there is a sex tape out there that is purported to have Hulk Hogan in it. It was recorded supposedly several years ago. It depicts Hogan with a brunette that is not his current or former wife, which is kind of interesting. Hogan does claim that there was a period in between marriages where he went crazy and he had this thing for brunettes. And look, who am I to doubt Hulk Hogan? Actually, we should all doubt Hulk Hogan, because 95% of the shit that comes out of his mouth is BS. I just find it funny that this sex tape comes out. It has him with a woman that is clearly not Jennifer, the woman he's with right now. But of course, no. This tape happened to be recorded in those 4 months or 5 months or whatever it was before I met Jennifer. I mean, what else is the guy going to say, for God's sake? I guess that's really all he can say. I know that the head of Vivid Entertainment, which is this you know, adult film company, I guess. The guy used to be, and maybe he still is, I don't know, but the Steve Hirsch guy was a huge wrestling fan in the 80s. And he actually wrote a letter to Hulk Hogan and his attorney, gauging their interest if they could meet. He had a very high interest in selling this tape and making money off of it, but he wanted to go about it the right way and make sure Hulk was okay with it. Obviously, Hulk is not okay with it. For the people who suggest that he leaked the tape to make money and to get his name out there, Hulk Hogan has got his tentacles in a lot of different projects and a lot of different things right now. He's actually on TMZ quite a bit. He didn't leak this on purpose. Believe me. He's an attention whore. I will give you that. This was not something I think that was done on purpose. This is something that Hulk and his attorney are going to squash. I don't think the tape is ever going to get out. I pray that it does not. And that's that. There really is nothing more to say about that. The idea of Hulk Hogan in a sex tape is not something that appeals to me. Though I do wonder if at any point in this video he hulks up. I have wondered that, I will say. And I, you know, for example, maybe as things reach a climax in this video, perhaps he points at this woman and says, "You!" And then continues with his hulk-up routine. That would actually be kind of funny. But again, I don't need to see it. I just wonder these things because I have a demented mind, I admit. Let's move on, shall we? How about we get to shout-outs? If you have a shout-out you want to send in, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. thesolemonster@gmail.com. We'll start with iTunes. We actually got a review that was left a while back by Rick. Rick is a fan of the show for quite some time. He actually has gotten many of his friends to subscribe to the show in iTunes as well. So I wanted to give a shout-out to Rick, who left a review under the name Total Team Talk. And he also had a question here. I want to address this before I get to the other shout-outs. He was looking for the sound off where I gave my WWE business review, my business plan. I may have mentioned it on the show last week. That was actually episode 127, and he said he was having some difficulty finding it in iTunes because his library only went back about as far as episode 144. So anybody who wanted to download that show or any of the shows pre-144 may do so. If you go to the official sound off page on Podbean, which is quite simply, solomonster.podbean.com, I believe is the URL. On that page, it will list each sound off, the most recent ones. If you go on the right side, the right column on that page, you'll see it's archived by different months. I don't remember exactly what month that episode was done, so you'll have to kind of scan through them. But it was probably back in 2010 would be my guess. And you can click on each month, and it will give you the number of each sound off, and you can actually stream it right there on the page or right-click Save As and download it. So that's the easiest way for you to find something. If you don't see it listed in iTunes, you can search it through the official Solemonster Sound Off Podbean page by doing that. So anyway, thanks to Rick for recommending the show and leaving a review. I also have my trusty iPhone 4 here in my hand. With iTunes open, I just want to give a shout-out to two other people who left reviews for the show this week, one of whom was Gerald Moore. I know Gerald is a big fan of the show. He says, "This podcast is the best in the world." Somebody should tell CM Punk and Chris Jericho that. He says, "The only one I would actually listen to. I speak for us when we say thank you for your insight and your humor, facts, and a different approach to many aspects of wrestling. Not to mention, I can listen to this while working out at work, on the train, and awkward car rides." That comes from Gerald. And also, Tim Billups left a review for the show as well. "By far the best podcast out there," he says. "I look forward to each Monday when I get to work and download and listen while I go through reports." See, so you can listen to the show while you do homework. You can listen to it while you actually work. Put your headphones in. Your boss won't even know that you're not actually working. So if you want to leave a review on iTunes and get a shout-out for it, by all means, please leave one. It definitely helps the show's overall ranking. It helps bring in new listeners, which is always a good thing. And I will be more than happy to give you a shout-out on the show if you let me know about it. A couple of other quick shout-outs here before we get to the mailbag questions. Roger Penland, big fan of the show, also a presence on our Facebook page. He celebrated a birthday this week on March 7th, so I wanted to give Roger a shout-out. And also one here from Rodney, and I want to read you what he sent me here. He says, "Solemonster, love your show. Best of all the podcasts I listen to. I look forward to it every week. My daughter is turning 16 on Tuesday this week. Can I get a shout-out for her? Her name is Tanis. I nicknamed her the Hammer Monster during her volleyball season, a knockoff of your name. Keep up the great work." That comes from Rodney. I really appreciate that. Happy birthday to Tattis this week, and the Hammer Monster. That's a pretty badass name right there. See, if I were on a volleyball court opposite somebody calling themselves the Hammer Monster, I'd position myself as far back as possible. I wouldn't want that ball checked into my face. So, as I said to Rodney now, she just has to live up to expectations. I mean, if you're going to take the monster name, you've certainly got to live up to the billing. So hopefully she'll have a dominant season. So thank you to him, and happy birthday to her. And again, if you have shout-outs, questions as well, as we head into the mailbag here, again, thesolomonster at gmail.com. Let's knock off a couple of questions here from you guys. I got a whole bunch of them this week. This one comes from Aaron. I just got done watching the Four Horsemen DVD, and I was wondering, do you think Ric Flair's career would have been better, worse, or the same if he was not with the Four Horsemen? Thanks for the hours of enjoyment, and keep up the great work. I don't think his career would have been better. I think his career would have been probably exactly as it was. Worse, you know, I wouldn't say worse. I think that's the wrong word. I think by him being part of the Horsemen, it enhanced his career. You know, the Horsemen will go down as probably the most legendary faction of all time. The NWO may be the most successful in terms of how it carried that company for so many years before it got driven into the ground. But the Horsemen, people still think about the Horsemen. They still revere the Horsemen. The Horsemen just had a DVD made for them, for crying out loud. The Horsemen as a unit are going into the Hall of Fame. So the Horsemen were a very big deal. The stories are legendary. Perhaps Flair would not have partied as much if he wasn't part of the Horsemen. Maybe he would have saved money. I mean, let's be honest. Ric Flair is Ric Flair. I don't think his life or his career would have turned out much differently than it did. So of those three options, I would say his career probably would have gone the same pretty much, but it wouldn't have been better. I think he was definitely better off for being part of that unit. And it certainly, it led to some interesting matches and interesting feuds. And I still remember when Sting joined the Horsemen and they turned on him, and, those War Games matches that the Horsemen were in. I mean, again, that's the stuff of legend. And it's a unique situation, too, because normally when you talk about factions, especially factions in recent years, if you look at Evolution, it's a great example. There's a modern-day adaptation in many ways of the Four Horsemen. Flair was a part of the Evolution group. You have a group like that, and the purpose is to help get somebody over. At least one person, if not multiple people. You have a young guy. You have a guy that's not doing anything. They're not getting over. They work better if they have other people to play off of. A lot of times, you use a faction to help get people over. That's what it did for Batista. That's what it did for Randy Orton. But what makes this a unique situation is that Flair was already a main eventer. He was already a made man. He was a headliner years before the Horsemen even became an official faction. So it's not as though in the absence of the Horsemen, Flair would not have been a main event guy. He was going to be a main event guy no matter what. He had already been a main event guy for many years. If anything, I think the question might be, were the careers of people like Lex Luger and Barry Windham better or worse, would have been better, worse, or the same had they not have been in the Horsemen? Luger also, to some degree, Luger was a big star, and Luger, I think, would have been big no matter what because he had that look that was so important at the time. He looked like he was chiseled out of stone. But for the time Luger spent in the Horsemen, I think it only enhanced his career. Barry Windham is going into the Hall of Fame. He's going to be part of this Horsemen group because a lot of people think that was the best incarnation of the Horsemen. And Barry Windham, I dare say, his career probably was better off for the time he spent with the Four Horsemen, even if it was only a couple of months or whatever it was. But for Flair, I don't really see that it would have made a difference one way or the other. This letter here comes from James, who writes, "And I am a pretty new fan to the podcast, but I have downloaded all the old episodes that I could, and I must say that so far, fucking great. The wit and opinions are spot on to how a damn fan of pro wrestling should feel. Now, my question is this. I have been checking out Dean Ambrose / John Moxley, as he was known on the independent scene, checking out his matches on YouTube. This guy has all the tools. So how would you feel about him debuting at WrestleMania 28? This guy could hang with Jericho and Punk on the stick and is maybe even better than them in the ring. I realize that a Mania debut could kill him, but I feel that this guy is something special. He could fuck Punk over and cut a promo about how Punk came into his house and embarrassed him, so Ambrose is merely returning the favor." I assume what you're referring to is that match. For those of you who don't know, I'm pretty sure I talked about it. I raved about it, I think, on the show when it happened. Last year, at some point, on one of his days off, CM Punk actually went down to Florida Championship Wrestling. They were having a show. And he agreed to do an angle and work a match against Dean Ambrose. And the match was, and I don't know if it's still on YouTube. It was. If it isn't yanked by now, you might still be able to find it. It was a great match. I mean, this was a match that could have easily been on TV, easily been on pay-per-view. And Punk did this on his day off. This is not something he had to do. So, again, it really goes far in showing how much passion he really has for what he does for a living. But Ambrose hung with him every step of the way, and Punk beat him, of course. But as Punk said on the microphone when the match was over, listen, you know, he kind of dropped character and said, I wouldn't do this for a guy unless I knew this guy could go places and I had big expectations for him. So even Punk knows that, you know, Moxley, Ambrose, whatever you want to call him, is going to be a big deal. This guy does have all the tools. He's great on the microphone. He's got a kind of a crazy, almost loose cannon Brian Pillman type of character, and his work in the ring is excellent. You know, he had great matches on the indie scene and all that. As a matter of fact, one of the last indie shots he did, if I remember correctly, it was either Dragon Gate, I think it might have been Dragon Gate USA. He had a main event match against somebody, I forgot who, I don't know if it was Johnny Gargano or somebody, but it was actually at B.B. King's in Times Square. So it was right in my backyard, and I didn't go to the show. It was on, I think, a Tuesday night or something. And I kind of regret not going now, because I had heard big things about Moxley. I had never seen him live. You know, all the Ring of Honor shows I had gone to, he was never on any of those shows. I don't even know that he was in ROH. If he was, it was probably very brief. So I kind of regret not going to that last show that he was on at B.B. King's. But as far as Moxley debuting at WrestleMania, I don't like the idea. Somebody had a similar question about putting all the big FCW guys in a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania, and I just did not like that idea at all. I suggested maybe using a guy like Seth Rollins. If you wanted to get him on TV, you could do something like a Battle Royal maybe on Raw or SmackDown with a bunch of job guys and stick Rollins in there and let him kind of be the star of the match. You know, he can show off some of his moves, and he can toss a bunch of guys. He wins, and so people already have an idea. Hey, this guy's kind of a big deal, and then you kind of get him over that way. But I will say this. I think that Ambrose doesn't have to work his way from the bottom up. He's that good where if they really want to put some new blood into the mix, you don't do it at WrestleMania. You don't need him interfering at WrestleMania. I don't like that idea. But maybe the next night on Raw, you know, and I assume this Punk Jericho feud is going to continue probably with a rematch at the next pay-per-view after that and maybe a third match. So that feud is still going to continue. Maybe you wait until the very end when Jericho is going to leave and Punk has to move on to somebody else. That's maybe when you bring Ambrose in. But having Ambrose come in and screw over Punk at some point, interfere in a match, Punk wins, let's say, his last match against Jericho, the feud is now over, Punk is celebrating, and then from out of the crowd comes Dean Ambrose to attack Punk from behind and beat the crap out of him and really lay into him. I love that idea. I fucking love that idea. It's very similar to how Brock Lesnar debuted. Brock Lesnar debuted on Raw the night after WrestleMania 18. He came out, there was a hardcore match going on with a bunch of dudes, he beat the piss out of everybody. He beat up Al Snow, he beat up Spike Dudley, he was dominant, he had Paul Heyman with him, and right then, a star was born. People knew this guy was a big deal. You could do something like that with Ambrose, but do it on TV. But you do it on TV for another reason. You do it on TV because you're going to have more eyeballs on you. I mean, I know WrestleMania is a big deal, so him, you know, interfering at WrestleMania, he'll forever be a part of WrestleMania lore. I don't like that idea. Do it on Raw. Do it on Raw. Do it on TV. You know, do it where it'll have more impact. Even do it in a pay-per-view main event, but not WrestleMania. Adrian from Australia writes in, John Cena is far from the WWE title picture at the moment because of his feud with The Rock. I want to get your prediction. From now, after WrestleMania, how long do you think it will be until John Cena holds the championship again? I predict April 2nd. That's what Adrian says. Well, I don't think it'll be April 2nd. Actually, I think we'll go most of 2012, I think, before John Cena gets that belt back. He'll obviously get it back at some point. Punk is pretty much locked in a feud with Jericho that I have to think is going to continue on for another month or two after Mania. And again, maybe if we're lucky, they'll go with the Dean Ambrose idea I just talked about and transition Punk into a feud with Ambrose and get some new blood into the main event scene. But Cena doesn't need the belt. He doesn't need the belt this year at all, to be honest with you. But I think they'll be able to hold off until later in the year. But they're not going to be able to help themselves, and that damn belt is going to find its way back around his waist. Troy writes into the show. Just wanted to say thanks for taking my question last week. I have one more. I've been studying video editing for about 7 years now, and I'm a huge fan of the video promos WWE and TNA produce. I tend to watch them over and over just to study their technique and styles. My question is, was there ever a video promo that WWE or TNA made that stood out to you? The Mr. McMahon's Utopia one that I talked about a few weeks ago, and by the way, thank you to everybody who actually found it on YouTube and sent me a link. That promo to me was very unique. in the way it was shot. And I believe that was, I think the Mr. McMahon's Utopia one aired with the break, was that the Breakdown pay-per-view in 1998? It was either that one or the Over the Edge. That was a great one. In early 2002, when Vince McMahon was bringing the NWO into WWE, and Ric Flair was trying to convince him not to do it, it would be a huge mistake to bring Hogan and Hall and Nash in, and they put together this video package to the Kid Rock song Lonely Road of Faith, which was basically a look back from the history of the WWF back to when it was the WWWF to the modern day. And they showed old footage from Madison Square Garden. They showed footage from the late 80s and the early 90s and the different, you know, generations. Hogan and Warrior face-to-face and Bret and Luger face-to-face, Austin and Rock face-to-face. It was a great, great video package. That stood out to me as well. Another one that stood out to me, I mentioned it earlier, WrestleMania 17, Austin vs. Rock, great feud, great build-up. We'll forget the Deborah stuff happened. That video they put together to Limp Bizkit's My Way, which was the video promo for that main event, awesome stuff. I don't care if you're a Limp Bizkit fan or not. That song helped make that video. That video was tremendous. It was a great piece of business. I mean, it was just great stuff. And the other thing that jumps out at me is from WrestleMania 26, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, their big rematch. And that video they put together with Placebo's Running Up That Hill, which was a cover of an original song. But the Placebo version, I love. I love that song. It's a dark song. It can be very depressing, but it's a great piece of music. And that video was tremendous. That Michaels Undertaker build-up video to their WrestleMania 26 match was a piece of fucking art. And I'm sure I can name a few other ones if you give me some time. Those are the ones that jump out at me. I am not a video editing major, but I can watch and appreciate those videos. It takes a lot of work to go into that. I think a lot of people don't realize that. They don't give the people who work on those videos enough credit for them. But they are just tremendous. And I know Steve Austin, for example, gave a lot of credit to some guy named Adam, who works for WWE, who put together the video for his Hall of Fame induction. That was another one. The Austin video when he went into the Hall of Fame, which ironically was set, I think there was a slow instrumental piece of music at the beginning of the video, and then it transitioned ironically into Cult of Personality by Living Color, which is now CM Punk's theme song. That was another great video. So if you ever want to, just spend an hour on YouTube one day searching for WWF or WWE great promo videos, and you'll probably get a whole host of them. And there's some really, really great ones in there. This question comes from Stuart, was watching some old YouTube video. Ironically, he's watching YouTube videos of the WCW angle, during which time Eric Bischoff challenged Vince McMahon. I was wondering what your take on the whole angle was and whether or not Eric Bischoff was seriously going to fight Vince. I remember in his book, Bischoff said it would have been great business for WCW and the WWF. So all I could think is, since Vince didn't go to WCW, why didn't he reach out and try to get the match on the WWF if it was such big business? Also, do you think a cross-promotional show between the two promotions anytime during the Monday Night Wars could have worked? No, 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 no. As a fan, it would have been tremendous, but that's all it was. It was a dream. During the wars, even when they weren't warring, I mean, I guess there really wasn't any, there was no period during which time both companies were in business that they weren't in competition with each other. It's just that the Monday Night Wars ratcheted things up so much, it made it 10 times worse. So doing an interpromotional show at any point was never going to happen. During the Monday Night Wars, you had a much better shot probably of getting laid by a supermodel, becoming president, and, you know, flying to the moon. Let's put it that way. As far as what Bischoff said in his book, I will reserve judgment on that because I have not read his book, Controversy Creates Cash. I've heard good things. I've heard bad things about it. But as far as Bischoff saying, well, it would have been great business for WCW and WWE, he's so full of shit. He is so full of shit. Eric Bischoff does not have a good reputation with some people. He's a smart guy. He's a smart guy. He is big in TV circles. He has a production company. He's a successful guy. I give him credit for all that. But when he was running WCW, he was not the most well-liked guy. You know, and I don't know that his television character was all that different from him in real life. He just came off like a really smarmy SOB. And him challenging Vince McMahon, and Eric Bischoff is a very experienced, I don't know if he's a black belt, I know he's very good at some martial art or something like that. If he doesn't have a black belt, he's got some kind of belt. Apparently, it's very impressive. Good for him. So he can hold his own. And he went on Nitro. This was around May of 98, I think. This is when WWF was starting to finally build momentum with Steve Austin as the champion, and Eric Bischoff was starting to sweat bullets because Raw's ratings were on the rise. And actually, both shows were doing very well. But this concerned Bischoff. Bischoff was obsessed. I don't know if he talked about it in his book, but he was absolutely obsessed with Nielsen ratings. He lived and died by those television ratings, which is obvious to anybody. I mean, the Hulk Hogan-Bill Goldberg match took place on Nitro, for God's sake, not pay-per-view. That says it all right there. WCW had a pay-per-view, I believe, 6 days later. I could be wrong on that. I think 6 days later, the week after or something, was a pay-per-view. And they decided to do the Hogan-Goldberg match and title change on Nitro because they were at the Georgia Dome and there were a bunch of suits there from, you know, Turner Broadcasting. Why they couldn't figure this out months in advance and try to get this on pay-per-view and book the Georgia Dome for a pay-per-view is beyond me. But that just goes to show you what Eric Bischoff's main concern was. And he went on Nitro one night, looked dead in the camera, and he issued a challenge to Vince McMahon. He issued a challenge to Vince McMahon to come. This probably would have been their Slamboree pay-per-view in May. And, you know, as a WWF fan, I was intrigued by it. Obviously. I look back on it now, and I just think it's one of the most foolish things in the world. It's kind of like WCW sending Bill Goldberg on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno to issue a challenge to Stone Cold Steve Austin. I mean, you know, you just watch something like that, and it's like, who are you fooling? There's no way that WWF is ever going to accept some sort of challenge like that. So all you're doing is making yourself look foolish by doing this. You're looking petty and amateur, and they're never going to respond to you, and that's what Vince McMahon did. He didn't bother responding to Bischoff, because there was no way they were ever going to do business with them. How would they coexist? There was no way. There was no way it was ever going to happen. And Hulk Hogan would later go on to say, you know, he said to Bischoff at the time, listen, brother, what are you doing here? Vince will show up. He'll show up and he'll kick your butt. Vince didn't show up. He did the right thing. The best thing to do in that situation is to ignore it. Don't let them get under your skin. Instead, what Vince did was he focused on his own product. He went out there on TV every week to feud with Steve Austin. And I think in the end it worked out pretty well for WWF. I think in the end it worked out pretty well. But it was nothing more than a grandstand challenge. Vince McMahon was never going to accept it. He should not have accepted it, quite frankly. I mean, what would have happened if Vince actually showed up? I don't know that WCW would have even put him on television. And if they did, they probably would have set him up in some way. Because believe me, Bischoff did not want to go one-on-one with an angry Vince McMahon. As experienced as Bischoff may be in the martial arts, and he can hold his own, I'm sure that Bischoff pretty much knew in his heart that Vince wouldn't accept the challenge. And by refusing to accept the challenge, this somehow made him look like the bigger man, even though it made him look like a very small man. So it was very stupid to do, and you know, I'm a little bit older now, the benefit of hindsight and all that. If I were in Eric Bischoff's shoes, you know, to do something like that, to even acknowledge the competition on your show, I mean, think about it. He's on Nitro talking about Vince McMahon. It's like when TNA, and they do less of this now, but TNA was bashed mercifully, but for years, even by myself, because what they would do was they would constantly refer to WWE. People would come on television and talk about when I was in WWE, and WWE this, and WWE that, and Vince. All it does is make your promotion look second rate. You look like number two, which you are number two, but you don't want to look like number two. You want to be perceived as number one. And that's how I think Eric Bischoff came off in that angle. He came off as a very petty person. If I remember correctly, I think WWF may have actually contacted their attorneys to reach out to WCW, because what Bischoff was doing by promoting this, he was effectively trying to convince people that Vince McMahon, you know, the promoter from this other company, was going to appear on a WCW pay-per-view. That's the whole thing. He invited Vince on his pay-per-view, which is even more comical, because the thought that Vince McMahon would add a single dollar to that buy rate for WCW is just mind-boggling. And I think they might have actually contacted WCW and said, listen, you better back off this, because you're trying to convince you. It's a confusion in the marketplace, and you can't do that. And I think Bischoff went on the pay-per-view, and he went into the ring, and they did this stupid deal, I think, where they counted out Vince McMahon, who never showed up, and they raised Eric Bischoff's hand. It was so stupid. It was so stupid. And it just goes to show you the ego on these people. It's like Vince McMahon and the Stan Kroenke stuff. Remember when Raw got bumped from the Pepsi Arena or whatever it was, and He had a Stan Kroenke impersonator on TV, and he was lashing out at the impersonator because he felt so personally betrayed by this man. But yet, you have 10,000 people in the building who could not possibly care any less about what they're watching. But it's all about ego with these guys, and Bischoff is no different. Kenneth writes in, Steve Austin won the Royal Rumble in 1997, yet he went up against Bret Hart in a submission match that year at WrestleMania. Sid had the championship, and he defended against The Undertaker. So why didn't Austin get his WrestleMania title shot? Well, because Austin won the Royal Rumble that year under dubious circumstances. It was actually Bret Hart, technically, who won the Rumble. And the referees were distracted. Steve Austin, after being dumped out, crawled back into the ring, dumped out Bret Hart, and the referee saw that and declared Austin the winner. And the storyline at the time was they had Gorilla Monsoon, who was the WWF president at a time when you didn't need general managers. You had one president. But then again, you only had one brand. And Monsoon said, this is not going to happen. I'm not going to allow this. We're going to have a Final Four match. This was before they came up with the name Fatal Four Way. They called it the Final Four. It was an in-your-house pay-per-view between the Rumble and WrestleMania. And it was a four-way match for the WWF Championship, actually, because the title had been vacated. That whole period was such a clusterfuck because Shawn Michaels had beaten Sid at Rumble in San Antonio to win the championship back. So Michaels won back the WWF title. And the plan had been for Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels to have a rematch at WrestleMania 13 for the championship. And most likely, Shawn would return the favor to Bret, who beat him. You know, Michaels beat Bret at WrestleMania 12, and so we'd have a rematch, and most likely Bret would get his win back over Shawn. And coincidentally enough, Shawn Michaels comes up with a debilitating knee injury, goes on Raw in February, maybe 2 weeks or so after winning the championship, 3 weeks, and relinquishes the title. He forfeits the title to Vince McMahon and talks about how I lost my smile, I gotta find my smile, this could be a career-ending knee injury, the doctor doesn't know, his tears are streaming down his face. I thought, you know, him and Vince McMahon were embracing. I thought Vince was going to get down on his knees and Shawn was going to pull his pants down, but it never got to that. So the title was vacated all of a sudden. Bret never did buy the fact that Shawn had a knee injury. I always found it dubious how at WrestleMania, just a month later, after Shawn was on TV talking about how his knee is shot, his career may be over, he was at WrestleMania to do commentary for the main event, and when Shawn came out, he was doing the Shawn Michaels dancing and prancing. He looked pretty good for a guy with a bum knee. Anyway, the title was on the line in that Fatal 4-Way match. Austin was put in that match. I think it was the... Maybe it was the Final Four Men in the Rumble. I think that's what it was. I think the Final Four Men in the Rumble match were put in this match because Austin, I believe, dumped out Undertaker and Vader as well. And again, Gorilla Monsoon said, that's not fair to them. You were already gone, so we're going to put you in that match, which, if you think about it, that really didn't make any sense because if Austin didn't deserve it, he shouldn't have been in the match. But that's why they had a Fatal 4-Way match, and Bret won the championship. He lost it 24 hours later to Sid, and the Shawn-Bret match went up in smoke. It never happened, and that's why Austin, anyway, he didn't get his title shot at WrestleMania, because he didn't deserve it. There you go. But it would have been interesting, had Austin gotten his title shot and won the belt, you know, how different his career might have been had he gotten the championship as a heel when he was over at that point, but he wasn't nearly as over as he was as a babyface a year later. How different might his career have turned out if things would have worked out a little bit differently and had he gotten the belt in 1997? It's one of those questions we'll never know the answer to, but it's kind of fun to think back on. TJ writes into the podcast, your solo monster, finished listening to episode 208, and I realized when talking about the invasion or WCW in general, Sting never comes up. Just wondering what your thoughts are on the Stinger were from back in his prime as a performer overall, and do you think he could have made it in the old WWF? Love the podcast. He's been a listener, TJ has been, since episode 87, so thank you for that. I neglected to mention Sting, not on purpose. I just didn't think to mention him, to be honest with you. Obviously, if WWF had done the invasion the way that I suggested they do it last week, Sting absolutely would have been somebody I would have gone after, and Sting should have come in as part of that whole thing. Sting was the franchise, so to speak, of WCW. He was, you know, the icon, and this is a great segue to one other piece of business here I forgot to comment on before, but I know some of you have asked me about it. And this week, Road Warrior Animal put his foot in his mouth and was being interviewed and was asked about Sting. And basically, he said, Sting is not an icon. No way, no how. Until this guy goes to Vince McMahon and says, I want to come work for WWE, this guy can't call himself an icon. You can have an opinion on whether or not Sting is an... And I feel funny even using that word, icon. I mean, it's a relative term. But let's call Sting an icon because that's what he is. Sting has been in the business a long time. He's had a great deal of success. He has a great fan following. He's 53 now, 54. And for a guy his age, still moves around pretty well. He's a very well-respected performer. He's worked with some of the biggest names in the business. Ric Flair helped make him. And I think Flair would even say that Sting is one of his greatest opponents of all time, if not the greatest opponent he ever had, maybe aside from Ricky Steamboat. He had great matches with Luger, Hogan, Savage, and a ton of other people. And in TNA, you know, Sting is, in a lot of ways, Sting has made himself an icon in TNA as well, you know, regardless of his WCW career. It's hard to believe, but TNA has now been in business. It's going to be 10 years in, I believe, June. But 10 years TNA has been in business, which they deserve credit for. Somehow, some way, they've managed to stay in business that long. It's not too hard to do when you have, you know, an energy magnet or entrepreneur throwing money at you. But, you know, Sting has carved his own career out completely separate from WCW in TNA. And there'll always be that lingering question if he doesn't go to WWE, which at this point, I don't see it happening at this point. I mean, each year that passes is a year he gets older. Would Vince McMahon really throw big money at Sting at the age of 55 or 56 to first come into WWE at a time when even The Rock coming on television doesn't really mean much to ratings? And The Rock is a much bigger star to the WWE audience as opposed to this guy with some face paint who never set foot inside a WWE ring. I could see Sting coming out and getting a respectful reaction and everybody else just sitting on their hands going, who is that? And that's, in a lot of ways, that's very sad, but it's also indicative of the old fans that WWE has driven off in recent years. But, I mean, hell, if The Rock is on TV and doesn't mean shit to the ratings, and Triple H is on TV and he doesn't really feel that special anymore, bringing in Sting is not going to move the needle for WWE. I don't see what's in it for Vince McMahon, unless they, you know, if Undertaker is going to continue to wrestle, and this is not going to be his last match, and I don't think it will be. I suppose those rumors will continue. You could still do Sting and The Undertaker at WrestleMania maybe the next year or something. But for Road Warrior Animal, who worked with Sting and I thought was friends with Sting, and maybe he still is, to say Sting's not an icon and blah, 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 but the reason he's not is because he didn't work for WWE. Therefore, you're nothing special until you've worked for Vince McMahon. Get the fuck out of here. Who's he kidding? That's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. Most people have worked for Vince McMahon at some point, and WCW. Sting is one of a very rare breed who can honestly say that he stayed loyal to the organization that helped make him what he was. I mean, it's like Hulk Hogan in WWF. Hulk Hogan was already a big star when he came to WWF. He was a big star for Vern Gagne in the AWA. But it wasn't until he came to the WWF with their national presence that he shot off into the stratosphere and became the biggest star in the history of the business, with the potential exception of The Rock, who has become a bona fide Hollywood star. But Hogan became the biggest star of all time, and he owes a lot of that to Vince McMahon and the promotional machine behind him in the WWF. He owes a lot to Vince McMahon when it comes to that. So when a guy like Hulk Hogan or Randy Savage, who made their name in WWF, leaves and takes his ball and goes to Ted Turner and goes to WCW. I mean, the guy can do whatever he wants to. He's going to go wherever he can make the most money. I know why Hogan did it. I know why Savage did it, because he didn't want to be an announcer. Vince McMahon said, we have a new generation. And Savage said, well, fuck this. I'm going to go to WCW, make a lot of money, and I'll get to work matches there. But Vince McMahon will look at that as some sort of great betrayal. So what Animal is saying is that because Sting didn't turn his back on WCW and betray the people that helped make him what he is, therefore he's not a big star. If anything, I have infinitely more respect for Sting for not going to the WWF, for staying with WCW, for staying with the company that helped make him a big name. So obviously I disagree with Animal. I think he's full of shit. And it's kind of funny that, you know, he's making these comments and everything at a time when his brother, who I will admit, his brother is not exactly, I know he calls himself Mr. Excitement on TV, but John Laurinaitis is great in his role, and it's just kind of funny that in 2012, Johnny Ace is a much bigger star on television than Road Warrior Animal. Maybe it eats Animal inside to see that his brother is actually more popular than he is on TV. I don't know what it is, but obviously I don't put much stock in his comments. I think he's full of crap. I think Sting, we can safely call Sting an icon and a legend, you know, in the business, and just ignore what Animal said because I just think he's full of crap. Jamie writes in, my question is about D'Lo Brown. Beginning in the Attitude Era, it seems as though D'Lo is getting a push, becoming the first person to carry both the Intercontinental and European titles at the same time. My question is, whatever happened to his push, and why did it end? Also, what are your thoughts on D'Lo? I like D'Lo, actually. I thought D'Lo was a very entertaining character. And I will dare say, I give Vince Russo credit. I give Vince Russo credit because one of the things he was strong on, at least back then, was finding a role for some of these mid-card guys. You know, D'Lo Brown was not a main eventer. He wasn't going to be a main eventer. Especially, that was the worst time, probably, for somebody like D'Lo to even attempt to become a main eventer, even if he had a shot, maybe in another era. But you were talking about a time period in wrestling where you already had guys like Austin and Rock and Triple H and Foley and Undertaker and later on Angle and Jericho, all at their peak. There really wasn't any room for somebody like a D'Lo Brown or even a Billy Gunn, who they tried very hard. They tried to push Billy Gunn as a potential main event guy, and that fell on its face. But in that role, D'Lo was fantastic. He went from being just some random dude in the background raising his fist as a Nation of Domination member wearing a funny hat to being a main player in the mid to upper card in WWE. And like you said, he held an Intercontinental Championship and European Championship at the same time. He was over with the audience. And I think I have to go back and see what D'Lo was doing in mid-1999. I think his real big push pretty much was already done at the end of 98. But I think him dropping draws on his head and paralyzing draws in that match at the SmackDown taping at Nassau Coliseum in October of 99, I believe it was, probably didn't help his cause. I mean, I'm pretty sure, I never really heard that D'Lo was blamed. It wasn't like Miz not catching R-Truth on Raw, where he got, you know, read the riot act backstage and clearly could have done more to protect his opponent. I think what happened was, and this match never aired, by the way. This was a match, I believe it was a dark match, and I was not at Nassau Coliseum that night, so I did not see it live. I believe what happened was D'Lo had this move where he would pick somebody up in a powerbomb position, and he would run and deliver a running powerbomb. I think that's the move where something happened. I don't know if D'Lo slipped or Draz just fell the wrong way, but that was the move that basically crippled Draz for life. He's been paralyzed ever since his career ended, and I'm sure that has to fuck with your mind on some level, too. I don't know that maybe psychologically D'Lo was never the same after that, but any push he might have been getting up to that point, he certainly wasn't getting much of a push after that. In 2000, which I think was his last year, actually, with WWF, he was never the same after that. So that might have actually had something to do with it as well. But I'm pretty sure his main push was pretty much over long before that incident with Draws ever happened. But I always liked D'Lo. You know, his facial expressions were always comical. They're so over the top. I mean, you can see the picture on my Facebook page. It's in that top bar. There's some photo thumbnails on my main Facebook page, and somebody tagged me in that one. That was I talked about the Brandon Jacobs angle that TNA did a couple of weeks back with the football player attacking Billy Ray Cyrus, Bully Ray. And D'Lo Brown was one of the agents. He's now a backstage road agent in TNA, and he came out holding Brandon Jacobs back. And even then, D'Lo is on TV making these fantastically over-the-top faces, like he is shocked by what's going on, and he can't believe what he's looking at, and it's just great. So I always liked D'Lo. And D'Lo, by the way, it's worth noting, is a very smart guy, too, because before he became a wrestler, he was a certified public accountant, which already means that D'Lo Brown is much better at math than I am. This question comes from Abbas. Mick Foley is a legendary superstar and does sometimes get what he wants. So this question has to do with what he recently said about the Hoski message being portrayed on WWE television. Many people were debating in the comment section that Mick Foley is dumb for saying that name-calling should not be allowed in WWE if they support anti-bullying campaigns like Be a Star. I do think he's right, but I want your opinion on this, please. Was what Foley said right or wrong? And as I said to a boss in my email back to him, I think what Foley said does make sense. You know, you're trying to tell kids on the one hand it's not okay to call each other names, yet you have Rock out there calling John Cena a Fruity Pebble bitch every week with the fans laughing in approval. You know, it's mixed messages here. It's a double standard. If they're going to do the Be a Star campaign, which I think is a nice idea, I would say limit the name-calling to dastardly heels, you know, who get their comeuppance at the end of their storyline. Or they could just drop the PR campaign. Let's be honest, that's all that it is. Drop the PR campaign and just let pro wrestling be what it's meant to be. Enough of the politically correct bullshit. Just let pro wrestling be pro wrestling. That's what it is. People call each other names. They fake beat each other up. We laugh. We cheer. We cry. We move on. That's what wrestling is. This last item is not so much a question, but it is a story that I popped huge for when I heard it. One of our longtime listeners, Jonathan, who actually lives in, he lived in Taiwan. Now he moved out of the suburbs, and now he lives in downtown Taipei. I believe he originally comes from Canada, but he's written in before. And he shared an amazing story with me. You know, I've ranted about WWE taking Brodus Clay off of television. And, you know, he'll probably be back on TV at some point, but the fact is, it's been well over a month. He hasn't been on TV. He was one of the more entertaining aspects of Raw, and they took that away from us. And I've been very upset about that, because we need more fun things, and we need more fun characters on TV. And this guy took the character, made it his own, and I think was starting to get over, and they yanked the rug out from underneath him, and that pisses me off. But this is a story that WWE should hear, because Brodus Clay has helped our young friend here in a very, very unique way. Let's put it that way. I'm going to share his story with you right now. Again, this comes from Jonathan, who says, I wanted to share a personal story with you because it relates to one Brodus Clay. I have a personal interest, he says, in getting the Funkasaurus back on television, and I will explain why. He says, like Brodus, I too am what many would call horizontally gifted. I've always been a big guy, but after I got divorced in 2006 and then left my home country of Canada to move to Taipei, I grew to morbidly obese proportions. And he gives a description. He says he ballooned at one point to over 150 kilograms in size. He says, while I now live downtown, I've managed to get down to about 141 kilograms. You can imagine that I've developed a lot of issues regarding my own self-confidence and body image. Enter the Funkasaurus. For me, this guy was like a breath of fresh air. He's a guy who, he's even fatter than I am, yet he's getting paid to dance around and tear his clothes off in front of arenas full of people. And the crowd loves it. The best thing is, for the most part, the crowd seems to be laughing with him rather than laughing at him. Last month at a friend's company Chinese New Year party, there was a stage with various acts performing. One act was a smoking hot girl. She had a crop top, mini skirt, fishnets, a thong, high boots, the works, who was inviting guests to come up on stage and dance dirty with her.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
She got one girl to come up and dance for a bit, but everyone else was being way too shy. So, thinking of the Funkasaurus, I mustered up enough courage to go on stage with her. I didn't know what to expect, but before I knew it, I was bumping and grinding. The girl and I were filling each other up, and everyone at the party was shouting and cheering.
I would like to do a romance inside of you.
Just over a week ago, I met a local Taiwanese girl through Facebook, and we went to a local bar. If I didn't have my newfound confidence, I would have assumed she's not interested, left the bar early, and gone home. But again, thinking of Brodus, I decided to stay and see how things progressed. After sharing a pitcher of beer, she followed me back to my place, and I got laid for the first time in almost 3 years. And while I don't see us in a relationship together, I have a date with a beautiful Croatian girl next week who I never would have even asked out were it not for my newfound confidence. So, for the benefit of fat guys everywhere, I really hope the Funkasaurus returns to television. Sometimes it's good to have someone who can inspire you. And it was Brodus Clay who inspired me to get up off my ass, stop feeling sorry for myself, and steer my life in a more positive direction. That comes from Jonathan. That is fucking awesome. And that is a fine way to end the mailbag on this episode 209 of The Sound Off, which will now go down in infamy for one of the greatest stories I've ever heard. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is my handle. We're picking up a lot of Twitter followers, so you'll want to get on there before I head down to Miami for WrestleMania. I'm sure I'll be you know, tweeting like crazy and uploading pictures and videos and all that good stuff. So follow me on there. Friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. This week, as every week, we'll have a thread going during Raw. We have a lot of interaction on that thread, a lot of debate back and forth. It's all a lot of fun. And again, if you would leave me a review on iTunes, you can find the show on there very easily. I would appreciate that. And subscribe to my YouTube channel. The Solomonster is my username on YouTube. I got to get some new stuff up there soon, so I promise I will try to do that. I have a vintage episode, number 3, which will go up. I don't know when, but it'll go up soon. And those old shows, I think it's going to be a YouTube exclusive type deal where when I put them up, it'll be on YouTube only. So I'll let you guys know when that happens. But there's all different kinds of ways to stay connected to the Solomonster and the Sound Off. You have no excuse not to be a part of this family in some way, shape, or form. And as always, I appreciate the support. We're having more people listen, more people follow each and every week. We have episode 210 coming up next week. We're already 10 episodes deep beyond episode 200. I feel like it was just yesterday I was planning for the big 200th episode, and now we're already almost 10 shows deep. Time flies when you're having fun. So until next time, be well, stay safe, enjoy Raw this week, and I guess we'll see if Joseph Park makes another appearance on Impact Wrestling. Again, go back and check those segments out. It was actually really fascinating stuff to see Abyss without the mask, out of character, and all that good stuff. So check that out. We'll be back next week. Until then, take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella. This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.